Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Mason Adams. Red Terry's property in Bent Mountain, Virginia, is in the path of the Mountain Valley Pipeline. She says the place was beautiful.
Now, every time I look, I see the flags. I see the damage. I see the destruction.
Plus, almost everybody has a favorite cup or coffee mug. But how far would you go to replace it?
So this turned into like a real life quest where each little vendor or shop I went to, they would each give you like a little piece of the story.
And an effort to make old time music more available to Black musicians. You'll hear these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Mason Adams. People have been fighting the Mountain Valley Pipeline since it was first announced in 2014. The project connects natural gas terminals in West Virginia and Virginia with a 303-mile pipeline that stretches across some of Appalachia's most rugged terrain. Almost immediately after construction began, protesters tried to block it by setting up platforms and trees along the route and living in them. Teresa Terry, better known as Red, was one of those tree sitters, and she stood out. Red was in her 60s, and she wasn't just an activist. She was tree-sitting on her own land in a community called Bent Mountain. Back in 2018, I interviewed her from on the ground on the other side of a police barrier set up to keep supporters from sending her supplies.
Hey, Red.
Yeah?
This is Mason.
Hi, Red. I live up in Czech. How are you doing up there?
I'm doing okay. I'm almost past my withdrawals.
Oh, withdrawals for
my cigarette.
You've been up there for 3 weeks now, I guess, huh?
It feels like, a year now.
Wow.
I'm sure it's not that long. A lot of people up here are losing a lot of faith in law enforcement and politicians. That's not the way we like to be in Virginia. And someone brought me a shirt, but they're not allowed to bring me anything up here. And I think that, it sounds a lot like Hitler and his army. Anyway, let's go ahead and substitute MVD is what I like to call them, Mountain Valley because they are really screwing with everybody's property, everybody's faith, everybody's water. I don't want a bomb in my backyard. It's going to the side of me and behind me. I don't want to know that at any minute my whole family's wiped off the face of this earth.
Not long after this interview, Red was forced out of the trees by a judge who threatened her with a $1,000 per day fine. But Red and her husband Coles have continued to fight the pipeline in court. Last year, Congress approved a law that forced completion of the Mountain Valley Pipeline. Recently, I went back to Bent Mountain to talk to the Terrys and see what's happened since Red came down from her tree sit.
How long have y'all lived on this land here in Roanoke County? Did you grow up here?
I didn't grow up here. No, I grew up in town. My dad, he was an insurance agent. He had his own business. And I grew up in Roanoke. But this property's been in my family for, several generations. We've lived up here since we got married. We were married in the front yard. And pretty much came back from our honeymoon into this house.
So I remember the kind of pipeline being announced. When did y'all learn that the Mountain Valley Pipeline was supposed to come through this property?
March 20th, 2015. We got a letter from the county telling us that our property was on one of the proposed routes. 202 landowners at that time were served at one time because it was just quicker and easier to take us all to court. And I think we got one offer from them. It was a ridiculously low offer, kind of just said no. And the next thing I know, I'm being sued for eminent domain. There was no negotiating. There was no coming by and talking. No, hey, this is what we can, you know, sitting down and talking to you about anything. It's just, hey, no, we're taking it. This National Gas Act allows us to do that. It put it in the national interest. Unfortunately, the national interest doesn't include also protecting people's personal property, the water, or people's well-beings. It's just, it's an end of the national interest to get this pipeline in the ground and pumping gas.
So that was 2018. And here we are now in 2024, and I drove in, and there's still visible pipeline crews.
Oh, yeah,
all
everywhere.
Of, you know, the regulatory piece has had its whole journey. What's it like to live next to that for 6 years? And then, you know, it's off and on, I guess, but how do you come to terms with that?
For a while, you know, you still had the hopes that because they were still working on getting all their permits, and we were still commenting, and we were still meeting with people and these organizations who were, you know, supposedly there to prevent anything going wrong, or the things need to be done in a certain manner or the right way, would step up and say, hey, you know, but they just kept getting, you know, well, this looks good to us. This looks fine. There's nothing to see here. Go ahead. You know, you can do what you need to do. And it just gets more and more disheartening every day. And then now you just have we're still fighting it. There are still ongoing things. We're taking pictures. We're showing, you know, trying to show where the sediment's coming in. And, you know, they're basically not even getting a slap on the wrist anymore. I don't even want to be outside. I don't want to hear them. Just the fact that I know they're there is hard enough on me. It's tough sometimes. I mean, right now, I can hear them when I go outside. I can't see them because they have finished burying the pipe behind my house for the most part. They still have to test it and then restore it and everything. But, you know, like I said, that could still take years.
Red, you showed me your photo roll and a lot of these photos with the sedimentation and the slime. And I remember you scrolled down a good ways. And I was just like, I was overwhelmed in a way because you had other photos. Like there were photos of family and things like that. But so much of your photo roll was just documenting this damage.
Yes.
And that's, I imagine that's what y'all see like every day when you drive out too. Mm-hmm. You're just surrounded by it.
Oh yeah.
And you're dealing with a bureaucracy that seems unresponsive. So I'm wondering, like, what keeps you going? What gives you hope? What helps you get up, like, and keep fighting this battle day after day after day?
For me, it's the hope that maybe somebody somewhere will say, yeah, we need to stop this or slow this down and, you know, check this stuff. And a lot of it, too, is try to stop it from happening to somebody else. They're now proposing another pipeline that's going to be just as big as this one and just as bad as this one. And I have to say, I admire President Biden for halting any new LNG build out. We're already one of the biggest exporters of LNG in the world. The UK and European nations are trying to get away from LNG. And so the market for that is going to collapse, but, you know, we're going to force the country to build more infrastructure to support it we don't know where it's even going to go.
From day one, it has been nothing but lies. When your daughter, who is just as mean and ornery and just, in my eyes, perfect, looks at you and said, I won't be alive in 2 years because this bomb's going to go out. And we are in the blast zone. I'm 600 yards from that bomb. Everybody up here on this mountain right now, including myself, have pipes floating in water. That one out there floated in over 4 feet of water for a month. And they came in and took two pumps to pump it dry, heated it up, welded it, and threw it in there and covered it with mud. You're not supposed to cover it with mud. But hey, okay. they're in a hurry. They don't have to really do anything that they're supposed to do. What gets me up in the morning? I don't want to get up in the morning. I don't want to do anything. I have so much to do. And I'm paralyzed.
So now MVP is telling investors and the press that they expect to be completed.
Yes.
This spring.
End of March.
And in service. What do you all foresee in the future? What do you expect will happen?
Do I think they'll be done by the end of March? You know, I see pictures of pipes still above ground. I know they're still, you know, I have, like I say, I don't know how long it's going to take to bore under 81. I don't even know how that one's, if they've ever even done it yet. But I know that that's some really hard rock there. I know that they might have finished one of the bores at my sister's, but it took them a lot longer than they thought it was.
And they're still dynamite.
And they're still blasting over there. So either they've given up boring or they're just digging through. I'm not sure. I find it hard to believe this pipeline will be in service by the end of the first quarter of this year. I know that they still have to meet. In service means a lot of different things to me. You know, even if the whole pipe's in the ground, it still has to be tested. Right away has to be restored. FERC has to approve it. I was told that it could take till 2027 to get everything restored.
I mean, that thing you said about Miner saying she doesn't expect to be alive in 2 years.
Yes, because she thinks once they start putting gas in this thing, it's going to rupture and blow.
This is one of the steepest, unbelievable, someone sitting in an office drawing a line. Mm-hmm. And I understand what they did because they have tried to go to the largest landowners so that they don't have that many fights, so they don't have that much opposition.
Yeah, I told Coles when I came in, I was really nervous about this interview. When I was a Cub reporter at the Roanoke Times, and somebody would get shot and you'd get killed, and you'd go try to talk to their family. Like, that level of grief, that's what this feels like.
When Coles and I got married, and when we moved up here, this wall was falling in.
Yeah, it was bowed in.
This was screens that had been ripped and torn. These boards under here are this wide, and they were spaced to have plenty of room between them. And my dearest husband hooked a come along to a tree out here and pulled the house back out, put in the drop ceiling, put in the staircase here, put in the windows, screens on the ones that open. You know, we laid some floor, put some carpet down, opened the door, and every morning, I would get up. My kids got me blinds to close for the MVP. I've never had blinds up. But every morning I would go out here and look and just stand there and look and think to myself, I must be the luckiest person alive to have this view. Now, every time I look, I see the flags. I see the damage. I see the destruction. And I mean, my view, my hike through there, my apple orchard on the top where I went mushroom hunting, and all the critters in the world up here went up to that top orchard because the trees were so big. I had one up there that just produced so much. And all of that is now part of their LOD. And it just, it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking what they've done. I mean, I still love this mountain, but it's heartbreaking what they've done to so many parts that were so beautiful. And then the other day when my son was here, and I stopped at the mailboxes, and I parked on our road, our driveway, and I walked over to the mailboxes, and all the MVP guys were leaving. So I waved to them. And one guy went by me in a big blue truck, and he slammed on his brakes. Now, you got a whole crew leaving. He slammed on his brakes, and I'm standing at my mailbox waiting on them to pass. And he comes over and goes, "You don't know me. You don't know me. Don't be shooting the finger at me." And I looked at him. I said, "Are you a pipeliner?" He said, "Yes, I am." I said, "Well, I don't have to know you to know what you're doing to my land. And yeah, I'd like you to go to home." And he said, "I'm not going anywhere." And he's a little taller than I am. And he's like, "If you don't like it, why don't you move?" And I'm like, "My husband's family's been here for 7 generations. He goes, "I've been a pipeliner. We've got pipeliners for 6 generations. But he gets up over me. And I said, "Bring it on, motherfucker. You don't have anything that scares me. I'm old, I'm tired, and I used to be a redhead before you motherfuckers showed up. So do your worst. I'm not afraid." And a guy about 10 trucks back jumped out and came up and grabbed him. "Get in your truck and leave." He goes, "I'm not finished here." He says, "Yes, you are. Get in your truck and leave." And I've never had such evil thoughts in my life. I have never wanted to hurt anyone. And things are changing. Things are changing. I would like to hurt somebody really bad.
That was Red and Coles Terry, who own land along the Mountain Valley Pipeline. I reached out to pipeline officials about the Terry's claims. Pipeline spokeswoman Natalie Cox sent a statement. It reads, in part, "MVP project opponents continue to promote factual inaccuracies in support of their agenda. The MVP project has been subject to an unprecedented level of scrutiny, and the inspection process is working as designed. As has always been the case, completing construction and fully restoring the project's right-of-way remains the best method of permanent environmental protection." For a transcript of this interview and MVP's full statement, visit our website, wvpublic.org. One of the main concerns with any pipeline is its potential to rupture and leak. That worry could be bolstered by a new report about natural gas facilities across the country. Data compiled by federal regulators show that more than 11,000 gas storage facilities are vulnerable to leaking because of a design flaw. The Allegheny Front's Kara Holsapple has this.
In 2015, a blowout at the Aliso Canyon storage facility became the worst gas leak in U.S. history, releasing 100,000 tons of climate-warming methane into the atmosphere. In 2022, a well failed at Equitrans Rager Mountain underground storage facility in Cambria County, Pennsylvania, releasing natural gas for almost 2 weeks. Taylor Kate Brown reported why another disaster like it could happen again for Floodlight, a climate accountability news outlet. I asked her why the well at Rager Mountain failed and caused the leak.
The short answer is corrosion. Specifically, corrosion created by the exposure of the elements. One of the crucial things to know about wells in gas storage specifically is many of them were not built for this purpose. They were designed to and drilled to be production wells, so like a one-way trip. It doesn't automatically mean all gas storage wells will break, but many of them are several decades old now.
How many wells at storage facilities in Pennsylvania and across the country could potentially have a similar incident because of similar designs or setups.
So there are, in total, about 400 gas storage fields in the United States. 49 of those are in Pennsylvania. The study that I talked about in my story is based on federal data. There were more than 300 fields in the U.S. where there was at least one of these potential single point of failure wells. And in Pennsylvania, that was all but one of the fields.
Single point of failure is this term that's used. You describe it as wells that have a single barrier to failure. Can you just say a little bit more about what that means?
A lot of these were designed to only have casing. The gas flows through the casing, and there's not another barrier on top of the casing, or there's not a consistent barrier all the way down to where the gas is coming out. And so basically, if something goes wrong with that casing, there's nowhere else for it to go other than outside, whether it's the rock itself or the atmosphere. In sort of newer wells that are not designed for production, you might have cement, you might have additional tubing where the gas flows through the tubing instead of just through the casing. What I learned is that there's a lot of different ways you can structure wells, but in every case that they're talking about in this study, without other information, it's possible that if something breaks, there's nowhere else for that gas to go but outside.
What are the new or existing regulations that could prevent a well blowout from happening?
When Aliso Canyon happened in 2015, there was a federal task force that came together, and one of their recommendations was phasing out single point of failure designs. That ultimately didn't make it into the federal standards, but there was new regulation that came from that, including baseline risk assessments and additional data on these wells. I should also say there's a wider effort underway about methane leaks across the oil and gas industry, not just storage. One of these is the proposed waste methane rule. The rule would force companies to pay a fee, eventually up to $1,500 a ton, for major methane leaks like this. So if this fee had been applicable during the Ranger Mountain leak, it would be somewhere in the millions of dollars. So that might ultimately be a fine that would be a stronger incentive to avoid such a major issue.
That was journalist Taylor Kate Brown speaking with the Allegheny Front's Kara Holsapple. Brown's story was published by Floodlight. We'll link it on our website, wvpublic.org. Coming up, how far would you go to replace your favorite coffee mug? We'll have the story of a decade-long quest. You're inside Appalachia. I'm Mason Adams.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University, educating the people of our region and beyond for more than 150 years. More information at concord.edu.
Here on Inside Appalachia, our folkway stories come in all shapes and sizes. Often, they're stories about passing knowledge to new generations. And sometimes, a folkway story can be about something that was lost and then found. Folkways reporter Wendy Welch brings us this, about a potter who lost her mojo and the woman who helped her get it back.
Once upon a time, there was a girl named Ashley who loved unicorns.
I have been a unicorn fanatic since I was a little girl. My favorite movie in the world growing up was The Last Unicorn, and I really feel like unicorns for me symbolize hope.
Growing up in Northern Virginia, Ashley went to the Maryland Renaissance Fair every year with her family.
We couldn't afford to buy things at the Renaissance Fair. So you go and you go every year and you go, I'm going to grow up and become an adult and have adult money and spend it here.
At age 17, Ashley landed her dream job, working in a bookstore. When her first paycheck arrived, she set it aside for the fulfillment of another dream.
I had cash from my job at the bookstore and I could go spend it at the Renaissance Fair.
Ashley circled the entire fair twice before choosing.
And I bought this blue speckled mug with a braided handle, and it had a little unicorn in it that was sitting in it looking up, and it had cross legs and cloven hoofs and, you know, just very detailed mane and hair, and it was unique.
Ashley heeded the warnings not to let her mug straddle a pin inside a dishwasher. She took good care of the little unicorn, and it accompanied her to college a couple of years later.
I remember, like, the computer screen light hitting the mug and while I was typing up my reports, and it's just something that I like having next to me when I am writing.
Her junior year, Ashley acquired a roommate, a nice guy who did dishes. One day, he put Ashley's unicorn mug in the dishwasher over a pin.
And when I pulled it out, the whole thing just kind of broke apart into pieces and flew across my kitchen.
Her roommate promised to replace the mug when they went to the fair next year. But when they got there,
the shop was gone.
Ashley could remember the shop's location at the fair site, but not the name. She began asking vendors about the place that sold mugs.
So this turned into like a real life quest where each little vendor or shop I went to, they would each give you like a little piece of the story.
This is where the story travels back in time a couple of decades, and from Maryland to Ohio. That's where Ange Campbell first took up making mugs as a hobby.
I was a quiet and well-behaved suburban housewife. I was living in the city of Dayton back in the 1980s. And the city of Dayton Parks and Recreation Department Fine Art and Crafts Center offered pottery.
Ange fell in love with the sound of the wheel and the feel of the clay.
And there's a point when everything sings and you get the clay centered and it's not fighting you and you're literally listening to the clay with your hands. You can do it with your eyes shut. And everything just flows together and it's a wonderful, fluid, almost meditative tactile experience. And it just makes my heart happy. When I hit that zone, when everything flows, it's like a prayer. That is the point at which work is prayer. And everything you are and everything you have experienced ends up in that clay somehow, some way.
Ange took third place in the Riverbend Art Show. People began noticing her talent. A local artist approached. Did Ange want to join him selling mugs on the Renaissance Fair circuit? Ange wanted to, but she knew her work would have to stand out in a literal crowded field.
So I started including drinking companions. Yes, drinking companions, because everybody and his brother will make a mug. But mine come with someone you can talk to who will never, ever ask you for money.
The little unicorn that captured Ashley's heart was part of a long parade of mythical mug-dwelling creatures.
There are dragons, some of whom are grumpy, some of whom are pleasant, some of whom are downright curious as to why you're drinking their bath water. There are unicorns, mermaids, fairies, fauns. Anything that people can think of ends up in a mug. That way you will always have someone to drink with you and you will never spend the morning alone.
Fairgoers loved the whimsical practicality of Ange's work. Her mugs flew off the shelves.
A few years into it, my then-husband pointed out that I could make at least as much money making and selling pottery as I was making at a retail job, and he was right.
Ange and her artistic partners began circuit riding to Renaissance fairs around the country. Occasionally, she got to put on medieval garb and an Irish accent to banter with customers, but usually Ange was backstage somewhere working the clay.
It was a case of literally hauling the wheel and the kiln around with us so that when I was based somewhere, I would have the opportunity to work.
Sales were great until the 1990s recession hit. As sales slowly dried up, Ange and her husband divorced, and she made a difficult decision.
The pottery just wasn't going to be making enough money to allow me to continue to depend on that as my sole income. So given a choice between continuing to live indoors and enjoy the immense pleasure of running water and heat and light, I stopped potting full-time and started working again.
Ashley didn't know it, but she bought her unicorn mug the last year Ange sent her wares to the Maryland Fair.
I worked in the photo lab at Walmart, worked in the pharmacy at Walmart, worked as an alcohol and substance abuse addictions counselor.
Ange moved to Lancaster, Ohio, without husband or kiln, and soon pottery became part of her past life.
It seemed I never had enough time or energy simultaneously to go and get the shop set up and make the trip out there to continue to try to work on the pottery. So up until a couple of years ago, I wasn't potting anymore. I was just working. But then something very strange happened.
COVID hit. The American Renaissance Fair community set up a Facebook page so artists could sell their creations online during the lockdowns. That's how Ashley, now living in Virginia with a husband and two children, figured she could finally replace her beloved unicorn. She hopped online to restart her search.
All of a sudden, I had access to vendors that were all across the country. I put out the request. I described the mug. I think I got like over 300 comments.
Including from Bill, the artist who had suggested the Ren Fair circuit to Ange all those decades before. Bill was no longer Ange's business partner, but he was her friend and neighbor. Bill told Ashley how to find Ange.
I got contacted out of the blue by an absolutely delightful young lady, Ashley Nolan, who explained to me that she had been trying for more than 10 years to find me.
And she just couldn't believe that I'd been looking for her for like a decade.
Ashley's search had made Ange famous in the online Ren Fair community. People who owned one of Ange's mugs were proudly posting photos and turning down offers doubling the original purchase price. People who didn't have one were demanding details on how to place an order.
And she had to go on her own journey and her own quest.
Ange sat a few months with the news that someone had been looking for her that hard, that long, wanting what she had made that much. Her kiln was in a faraway outbuilding at a friend's farm, covered with dust and a tarp. She had no idea where her clay mojo was. But she liked Ashley, and she remembered the times the clay sang in her hands.
And I got my stuff from my friend who had been keeping everything stored in her barn.
Her friend Bill let her set it all up in his garage.
Bill put in the wiring, and we got the kiln running, and I started pottering again.
Ange fired off a series of unicorn mugs. She also shaped dragons, cats, hedgehogs, and myriad other drinking companions for the community now clamoring for her work. But Ange made sure the first unicorns went to Ashley, who ordered one mug for each member of her family.
Like the day before Christmas, I think, is when I got the package in the mail.
Ashley had told Ange about her children, her son Jerome's passion for red, her daughter Cordelia's favorite book, Honey Bunny. Ange sent a child-sized mug holding a cheerful, waving bunny.
And two mugs for my son, and with his favorite color red that had different dragons in it. It was fabulous. It was Christmas before Christmas.
Oberon, the son who joined Ashley's family in 2023, will be getting his own mug soon.
Having her create again it felt amazing to be part of that journey and part of her journey, too.
Ange and her kiln still live in Lancaster. 5 days a week, she works in an office helping people rent apartments, and on the sixth day, she creates things. Ange no longer depends on pottery for her living, which means she can experiment with designs.
I can drag out those notebooks from 40 years ago when my husband would look at a sketch I'd come up with and say, "You can't do that now. You'll never sell it for the price it'll be worth. It'll take up too much of your time. Forget that." So, yes, I still have all those notebooks from 40 years ago. And yes, now I'm getting to play with those.
I'm just so glad she came back to it. She didn't realize how much her art could mean to someone else.
Ashley takes her children on a camping trip to the Maryland Renaissance Fair every summer. She believes the quest of the broken mug put a lot of things back together through the power of community and the joy of art. Ashley got her mug back. Ange got her mojo back, and we got this story. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Wendy Welch.
That story is part of our Folkways reporting project, which covers arts and culture in the region. Check our website, wvpublic.org, where you can find dozens more Folkways stories, like this next one from 2022. Appalachian old time music brings together traditions from lots of different cultures. African and African American, Native American, and Scots-Irish. And yet, the contributions of Black and Indigenous musicians have often been erased or overlooked. In Floyd County, Virginia, one man has spent years working to make old-time music more available to Black musicians. Folkways reporter Nicole Musgrave has the story.
In a community center in Blacksburg, Earl White is teaching one of his fiddle students how to move the bow in a circular motion.
And it's all that circle. So that's what we're building up to, okay? We're doing it on one string now.
In old-time music, moving the bow in small circles helps create a drone underneath the melody.
So we'll build into that because what we're trying to do, we're trying to build in that drone. That continuous note is what they call that drone. There's my drone here, my notes dancing around it.
Earl's in his 60s, and he goes by the name Fiddlin' Earl White.
And then at some point, I shortened that to few.
As in F-E-W.
And after I thought about that, I was like, you know, there's a lot of truth to that. There are few Black fiddlers in the world today playing Appalachian string band music.
Earl lives on a farm in Floyd County, about 30 miles from Blacksburg. He came to old-time music by way of dancing. In the early 70s, when he was a college student in Greenville, North Carolina, Earl and a group of his friends got into clogging.
We would be clogging on the porch, clogging in the street. Clogging became a way of life.
They called themselves the Greengrass Cloggers and began performing around the country at folk festivals and clogging competitions. One day, Earl found himself backstage.
I was sitting in the green room, and sitting in the corner was this old Black man, and he was playing the fiddle.
It was Papa John Creech, warming up to go on for Jefferson Airplane.
In all of our travels of clogging, there were never any Black fiddlers that I saw. And so here he was playing the instrument as a fiddle, and I decided at that point, I want to do that.
Earl says the fiddle became an extra appendage. Those old-time festivals and fiddler conventions became a learning opportunity.
I'd find a jam, and I'd put my recorder under the seat of the fiddlers and just keep it running, and then I'd go and dance on my board.
Earl would watch how those fiddlers used their bows, and he'd listen back to the recordings. One of Earl's favorite players on the festival circuit was Tommy Jarrell, a renowned fiddler from Mount Airy, North Carolina.
I used to wake up to Tommy Jarrell. I would go to sleep to Tommy Jarrell. I was humming Tommy Jarrell. I was always whistling Tommy Jarrell.
Earl says when he was coming up as a fiddler in the 70s, he was one of the few Black people at old-time gatherings. Even though, he says, the music has always belonged to everyone.
A lot of what I advocate is that old-time music is not a Black music. It's not a white music. It was always played together.
But he says that at a certain point, Black people started to feel less welcome at these kind of events.
A lot of the young people who might have continued those traditions yet didn't find comfort in going to those festivals. So as a result, the music, you know, was being lost in the Black community.
Plus, they were interested in other kinds of music.
People didn't want to, like, square dance anymore. They wanted to shake their booties.
Yeah. But on occasion, Earl did run across other Black old-time players at festivals. Like the time he met Joe Thompson, a master fiddler from Mebane, North Carolina.
When he saw me standing there playing, I thought the guy was going to faint, you know, or die or something. But he thought he was the only and the last Black fiddler in the whole world.
Meeting Joe Thompson sent Earl on a quest to find other Black fiddlers. But he had trouble tracking down historical details.
Yeah, you saw a lot of pictures of Blacks holding banjos and Blacks holding a fiddle. But there's generally no names associated with the people.
Earl says this erasure of Black contributions is another reason that old time has been less popular in Black communities in recent decades.
If you don't see yourself represented in the music, then you'd there's no reason to feel like you've ever had any kind of connection to it.
But Earl's trying to change that. He regularly gives presentations about the participation and influence of Black players, and he organizes events around Floyd County that promote Black Roots musicians. He and his wife and bandmate, Adrian Davis, have also started a music camp on their farm. It's called Big Indian Music Camp.
To me, part of that preservation is, you know, teaching the younger people.
At this point, most of Earl's fiddle students are white. But he's teaching his preteen and teenage sons to play. And he hopes that by being an ambassador, he can perpetuate Black traditions in old-time music.
If a Black person, young Black person, sees another Black person playing, then you know, they can say, oh, wow, I could do that, and might be inspired. And so that's a lot of my focus outside of the fact that I just personally enjoy it. I just love it.
For Inside Appalachia's Folkways Project, I'm Nicole Musgrave in Floyd County, Virginia.
In 1905, Black civil rights leaders came together to form the Niagara Movement. The group has been described by historians as a precursor to the NAACP. It was founded in Canada, but held its second meeting in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. If you remember your history classes, that's the site of the John Brown Raid, which helped trigger the start of the Civil War. Now, a new documentary looks to highlight the movement's origins and trajectory. WVPB's Jack Walker reports.
The historic importance of Harpers Ferry is well known among West Virginians. Driving across the town's cobblestone roads, visitors pass preserved Victorian homes and storefronts shelved with old-time goods. Most visitors know Harpers Ferry as a hub of Civil War history. It was the site of an 1859 abolitionist uprising led by John Brown and Shields Green. But fewer West Virginians know that the town played another seminal role in U.S. history less than 50 years later. That's when a group of Black civil rights leaders visited the town's historically Black college known as Storer College.
They felt safe to come to a Black college and to also, which ties to some of what happened at the meeting, Harpers Ferry being the location of the John Brown Raid.
That's Scott Faulkner, who co-founded the Friends of Harpers Ferry National Historic Park. The group he's referring to is the Niagara Movement. The Niagara Movement was founded near Niagara Falls in 1905. It advocated for an end to things like sharecropping, segregation, and anti-Black violence in the shadow of the U.S. Civil War. It was also made up entirely of Black leaders, a rare feat for the time period. Today, the group might be best known as a precursor to the NAACP. Faulkner said the revolutionary history of Harpers Ferry aligned with the group's goals, which were viewed as radical for the time.
They saw a link between themselves as a force, basically an aggressive force on behalf of African-American rights. And they felt common ground and common philosophy with John Brown and the more radical abolitionists going back into the 1850s.
Harpers Ferry allowed civil rights leaders to unite in addressing racial injustice at the turn of the 20th century. Faulkner said that this part of West Virginia history is often overshadowed by the town's Civil War ties, but a documentary released earlier this month might help change that. Raymond Smock is a historian based in West Virginia who previously served as a historian for the U.S. House of Representatives. He contributed to a new documentary called The Niagara Movement, The Early Battle for Civil Rights. He hosted a screening of this film at Shepherd University earlier this month.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you all for coming out. This is a nice full house.
The documentary was released through Buffalo Toronto Public Media earlier this month. The documentary explores how the group was founded and later disbanded, giving way to the NAACP. Now, the film doesn't center on Harpers Ferry alone, but Smock said that it shows the West Virginia town offered a stepping stone for the early civil rights movement.
This was an amazing meeting at a very historic spot where John Brown's raid, some say, started the Civil War. And so there was a great interest in holding this meeting.
Many residents of West Virginia's Eastern Panhandle are already familiar with the Niagara Movement. But Smock said that this familiarity often doesn't extend to other parts of the state, let alone the country.
In the immediate vicinity and here in Jefferson County, West Virginia, the Harpers Ferry meeting of the Niagara Movement is pretty well-known history. but it's not well known in most other parts of the state or the nation as far as that goes.
Both Faulkner and Smock said that they hope the documentary helps people learn more about the Niagara Movement and civil rights history. And much of this history can be discovered right in West Virginia, at historic Harpers Ferry sites like the Storer College campus and the Storer College Museum. The multi-level Storer College Museum has exhibits dedicated to Black history, Black education, and the Niagara Movement. For Faulkner, the ability to discover these pieces of American history on a simple walk through town is what makes Harpers Ferry unique.
And this, again, was the philosophical and emotional link between the Niagara Movement in the 20th century and the abolitionist movement, especially the more forceful aspects of the abolitionist movement of the 19th century. So it was a really important melding of these two threads in American history.
The new documentary, entitled The Niagara Movement, The Early Battle for Civil Rights, can be viewed online for free. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jack Walker in Shepherdstown.
Earlier this year, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced it would consider federal protections for a rare Appalachian salamander. As Shepard Snyder reports, regional biologists have been advocating for that for years.
The yellow-spotted woodland salamander was named a unique species in 2018. A handful of years later, activists at the Center of Biological Diversity are part of a petition to get the salamander on the endangered species list. Will Harlan is the director of the center's Southeast branch.
In the past two decades, only 65 of these yellow-spotted woodland salamanders have been seen, have been even identified. So their numbers could be at a very low, dangerously low level.
Advocates say that means protecting habitats targeted by mountaintop removal mining. Harlan says the yellow-spotted is known to inhabit shale and sandstone outcrops across the Appalachian Plateau.
Endangered Species Act protections are not going to stop coal mining in Appalachia in any way, but what they can do is ensure that these last scraps of habitat for the yellow-spotted woodland salamander are protected.
The yellow-spotted is one of many types of salamanders that inhabit the Appalachian Mountains. Researchers call the region the salamander capital of the world.
There are more species of salamanders here in Appalachia than anywhere else on the planet. This is a really important biological hotspot for salamanders.
The salamanders have been found across 21 isolated locations across Kentucky, Tennessee, and the Virginias. Scientists like Zach Felix, associate biology professor at Reinhardt University in Georgia, say they're incredibly hard to find, even if you're actively searching.
You might go there 10 nights in a row and never see one salamander, even though you know that they've lived there. So they're very rare, they're hard to find. They're just sort of in that sweet spot of super keen animals for me. And they're cute as hell, too. So
Felix was part of the team that helped label the salamander as a distinct species. It was originally thought to be a type of Worley's salamander, native to Appalachia, but its coloring gave it away as unique.
They have like paired yellow spots down their back. And I know for most people, that's not maybe not remarkable, but When I first saw the animal, I thought, this is a different animal.
Felix says the idea of protecting it was a big reason for the research.
That was definitely part of my motivation for undertaking this project was, you're not going to protect an animal just because it has yellow spots, but if it's a different species entirely, it affords it more protection.
But Kentucky State herpetologist John McGregor worries that because these salamanders are so hard to find, advocates might be pulling from unfinished data.
It is so hard to find that we really don't have any true idea about populations. And the nine sites in Kentucky, only three of those sites have been visited more than once.
That includes two sites in Letcher County and one in Harlan, according to the Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife Resources. McGregor thinks the population of yellow-spotted woodland salamanders could be more continuous than what current data suggests.
You just don't have a population here and another population 100 miles away. We just have to figure out where to look for it and how to find it.
Other herpetologists, like EKU Division of Natural Areas Director Stephen Richter, say the process is worth at least going through.
Sometimes the way to get those data is to list something, just the way the whole process works, and then we determine its status and maybe downgrade it or determine it does need preservation and critical habitat designated.
Richter also says getting those habitats protected is important for the other local species and the humans surrounding it.
That's something we have to, as a human global population, understand that everything we're doing to protect other species and the habitat destruction or the pollution or all these things that impact them also impact us.
The U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife has the rest of the year to do research of its own. After that, it will make a decision on whether the salamander's status merits protection. I'm Shepard Snyder.
Till next time, thanks for joining us as we journey throughout Appalachia. Our theme music is by Matt Jackfert. Other music this week was provided by Jeff Ellis, June Carter Cash, Joe Dobbs in the 1937 Flood, Earl White, Tyler Childers, and Dinosaur Burps. Bill Lynch is our producer. Xander Alloy is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Eric Douglas. Kelly Libby is our editor. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org/insideappalachia to subscribe or stream all of our stories. Or look for Inside Appalachia on your favorite podcast app. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University, focusing on students' futures. Classes available at concord.edu/apply.